You people are alcoholic, all right. We're all having a hell of a time. Never really know why. My name is Barney, and I'm an alcoholic. And I love the enthusiasm that I have found here at this conference. Enthusiasm is a quality that I value in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love to be around enthusiastic people and to be involved with people who are active in Alcoholics Anonymous and who are participating in Alcoholics Anonymous in some way, either making coffee or putting up chairs or cleaning ashtrays or doing something to be involved in AA, either reading in a meeting or whatever. And it is nice to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to be here. See, I don't carry a great sense of enthusiasm with me. I never did. So I need to be around it. Because the minute that I am around people like you who are enthusiastic and who seem to love what's going on here, even though half the time we don't know what the hell it is that's going on here, that kind of thing is catching for me. And my first sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, a man named Keith, had that kind of energy and that kind of enthusiasm and that kind of spark. And I certainly did not. If you are within your first year here in AA and you're not feeling particularly enthusiastic and you're not particularly thrilled to be here, and you figure probably you're going to drink pretty soon anyway, and that's okay because you're probably not really alcoholic. Not the way they're alcoholic, but that you've just really been a victim of a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings most of your life, and that you're probably here by mistake, and besides, even if you're not, AA is not the answer to what's wrong with you. If you're feeling that way and uncomfortable and a little out of sorts and you feel like they all know one another and you don't know anybody and they don't like you, and if you're going through any of those kinds of feelings, I want to welcome you here because that's how I felt. I felt that way for a long time in AA, and I felt strange in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time after I got here. And any time that I go to a new group or a new meeting or a new city, and I have moved a couple of times in AA from one area to another, and any time I do anything like that, I feel strange and weird and out of sorts, and I get those feelings again. They all know one another, and I don't, and all that kind of stuff, see? Because left to my own devices, I am an isolated, lonely type of person who, because he's lonely and feels bad, will withdraw from you and go and hide someplace just so that I can be lonelier, so I can feel worse. But I will do that instinctively. And fortunately, I've been surrounded most of my life by people in AA who have not allowed me to do that, who have insisted that I be part of what's going on in AA, and that I be up front with the winners, as they always used to say. Sit up front with the winners. Because my tendency was to come into a meeting late and leave early and sit in the back and kind of scorn what was going on and take inventories of everybody and especially speakers and to kind of, in my own mind at least, to make fun of what was happening because it was all so dumb and so foolish and so childlike and really not an organization and not a place that had solutions for a person like me who had deep problems. And the simple solutions that were offered here were just not good enough. And so it was important for me to be around people that said, you got to sit with the winners. And of course, then the question becomes, who are the winners? And I had that defined a few years ago by a friend of mine named Clancy, who was talking about winners one time when he was doing the last marathon at the Southern California Convention one year. And his topic for that marathon was stick with the winners. And so he said, well, in order to do that, you got to find out who the hell they are. How do you define them? And his definition of the winners in AA are not just the people who have been sober for a long time, but the people who have been sober for a while and who are still doing it. The people who are still actively participating in their own recovery by going to meetings and by being involved and by being part of. And it is the people, for example, in this hall who have been sober for more than 5 years who are still doing it, who have not decided that they're okay now and they're fine and they got other fish to fry and other things to do and they got other places to go. Because that happens a lot in AA. I understand that. I feel that way a lot. I feel often that I've done enough. I really do. I feel like I've gone to enough meetings. I don't need to hear one more speaker. I don't need to hear one more person read chapter 5. I've almost got that one committed to memory. I know about the 12 steps. I don't need to know about the promises, you know. And so I've done enough, and it's time for me to get on with other things and to get my life involved in football games, you know. If you don't think there was a part of me that wanted to stay in the room tonight, you're crazy. I did. Go out there and talk to those people. See, here I am. I come, you know, some distance here, whatever it is, 1,500, 2,000 miles, whatever it is from California. They fly around here. AA is such a weird place. They fly you from over there to here. I've never been in Nebraska before. But they fly you here, and you come all that distance. Yeah, I left L.A. at 2:30 in the morning. It's the only flight I could get out. It's a weird, some kind of joke that my air power has, I guess. And got in here this morning and came and heard the tail end of a talk from Cahuenga, who gave a wonderful talk today. But she's in my home group in Los Angeles. I mean, I don't need to come to Omaha to hear Cahuenga, you know. But here I am, you know, and you come here, and I'm gonna spend, you know, 45 minutes or an hour here talking to a group of people that I don't know about something I don't even do anymore. I mean, you know. And somehow we're gonna finish this deal, and we're gonna get out of here. You know, we'll say the Lord's Prayer, and we'll all, you know, and we'll be just thrilled to death, you know, that we were all here, sitting here, and doing whatever it is we do, just having a hell of a time. And we'll all tell everybody how much fun we had, you know. But the bottom line for me is that in my measurement for anything that I do in AA, whether I'm making coffee for a meeting, which I like to do, that's my favorite job. I always think coffee making is the most important job. You get a pot of coffee made, you're pretty much moving in the right direction in AA. But whether it's making coffee or setting up chairs or being involved some way in a meeting or speaking or whatever, my measurement of whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing, you know, if you hear people in AA, was that a good talk? Did he give a good talk? Did she give a good talk? You know, who the hell knows? How do you measure those things? You know, with nobody taking ratings on this stuff. Thank God. But my measurement always is, if I don't have a drink tonight, this will have worked. And I genuinely believe that that's the measurement I have to use. If I don't have a drink tonight, then whatever I did to involve myself in Alcoholics Anonymous was effective. It worked. And that's my only measure. And so that's my hope. See, that's my genuine hope, is that I'll get out of here and get to bed sometime tonight, and I won't have to have a drink. And then if I do that, then this will have all been worth it. And it will have worked, whether Notre Dame wins or loses. And I, you know. They're looking a little shaky over there tonight. But if you are new here tonight, I want to welcome you, and especially if you got a bad attitude, because I had a bad attitude for a long time. But see, I had reasons to feel that way. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was not because I believed I was alcoholic. That was not why I came here. I came here because my drinking was enough like theirs that I figured that there was a place that I could go and I could maybe quit drinking for a while. That's all I had in mind. I just wanted to quit for a little while. I figured about, I don't know, 6 months, maybe less, maybe 3 months. And I could get my act together, and I would be okay, and I'd get some bills paid, and I'd get my life organized. See, my life was screwed up, is what was going on. And I figured I could get my life organized a little bit and get my head cleared up and get where I could think straight, and then I'd be okay. And I figured if I go to these AA meetings, maybe I can stay sober for a little while, and I can get my life together and get it organized, and then I can bid you all goodbye, because I don't need this stuff. I don't like organizations. I don't join nothing. I'm not interested in being part of nothing. I never have been. I don't like people. I'm not interested in being friendly. That ain't my gig, see? So, good. All you sick people, you need a lot of meetings. I can tell that right now. You're identifying with this sick stuff. But that's the way I was. And that's genuinely the way I felt. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I wanted to just quit drinking for a little while. Now, see, the problem was that when I drink, I look very alcoholic. And so over the years, a lot of people made that mistake. But I know and knew for a long time that I was not alcoholic for one very simple reason. And the reason is, when I drink, I feel better. See? And if I stop drinking for any length of time, I feel bad. So that doesn't sound to me like a drinking problem. A drinking problem, it might have been a problem for other people, but it wasn't a problem for me. Because when I drink, I feel better every time. It always works, and it's effective for me. And so sobriety is really the problem. I have a terrible sobriety problem. If I stay sober too long, I get crazier than hell. I get kind of nervous and edgy and uncomfortable and just a little weird, and I don't like it. And so it's necessary for me after, 4 or 5 days or a week of sobriety, it's necessary for me to drink again because I need to relax. I got to take the sharp edges off. See, I'm under a lot of pressure in my life. I've had anxiety and frustration and pain and fear and terrible feelings all my life about just being alive. I was born in the wrong century. I'm living on the wrong planet. Something's wrong. I don't know what the hell's wrong. It ain't drinking. Drinking makes me feel better. And so I drink again. You know, Jesus, just a couple of drinks, for God's sake, no big deal. I'm just going to go have a couple, just to ease it off a little bit. And I have a couple of drinks, and guess what? I feel better. Every time. It's just wonderful. And there is this kind of sad peculiarity about it all. Oh, it is. It just breaks your heart. It just... Because here I am, a frightened, inadequate, weird guy walking around most of his life trying to look normal, trying to look like I got it together, trying to be a grown-up. And I'm just crazy most of the time, and I can't... They never put you away, by the way, for being crazy. They only put you away for acting crazy. So the trick is, act okay, and they won't know. And I had learned very early on in life how to act okay. I knew how to act like I was part of everything. And I knew how to look like I was okay. But I was crazy, and I knew that. I didn't know what the hell to do about that. I was just weird. I was different. And I didn't know what to do. Now, you know, it's just a sad thing, though. I've got this one thing that I discovered somewhere in my middle 20s. I just made this magic discovery that when I drink alcohol, I feel better. I've got this wonderful thing going for me. And yet there's this sad peculiarity about it. And it is this. It's so simple. It just kills me. for some reason or other, when I start drinking, I don't seem to be able to stop. Isn't that terrible? It's just, God, that's awful. Because, see, I get real weird behind alcohol. I do strange things when I drink. I have a tendency to overshoot the mark. And then a whole series of peculiar things happen to me. I tend to travel a lot. I move around a lot when I drink. I go from bar to bar, and I go from sometimes city to city, and sometimes I go from country to country. And I don't mean to. It wasn't a plan that I had going in. It was just it happens. I end up in places. I drink and I go places. And I don't seem to be able to get a handle on that. And I forget, you know, sometimes. Matter of fact, I forget a lot. I forget who I talked to. I forget where I was. I forget how I got where I was going. I forget everything. How I could have spent so much money. I forget the places I was in, who I was with. Just forget. I forget where my car is. I just forget stuff, and that's embarrassing, because, they always ask, you know, where have you been? Who are you with tonight? You've been gone 4 days. Don't you think that's a little weird? Yeah, it is. But really, not much you can say, you know. You just make a vow never to drink in that bar again, because... or drink with those people again, or... You know, next time I got to watch it, I got to be a little more careful. I can't be so bizarre and weird and strange. Because, see, I'm trying to be normal, and I'm trying to look normal, and I'm trying to live a normal life. I grew up on the south side of Chicago in an Irish Catholic neighborhood. I had a lot of Catholic education as a child. I was an altar boy. I had the Dominican nuns for 8 years. I had the Carmelite priests for 4 years at Mount Carmel High School. I had the Holy Cross Fathers at the University of Notre Dame. And they threw me out of there after 3 years, by the way. I was a Notre Dame graduate until I got the AA. But... they insist here that you tell the truth even if it makes you look bad, you know. Kind of weird outfit here, but I had a lot of formal training, a lot of formal education, and I knew a lot about God by the time I was 20 or 21 years old. I intellectually understood God. I understood the arguments for the existence of God. I understood how to talk about St. Thomas Aquinas and the Summa Theologica, the proofs of St. Augustine, and I could argue the existence of God for any length of time with people and prove to you conclusively and absolutely that God does exist because, for example, of the order and design in the universe and that there had to be a prime mover and there had to be a prime intelligence and, you know, how many times do you have to throw up the parts of a bicycle for him to come down a bicycle? You know, argue against the Great Bang Theory and all that kind of stuff. Now, I could go on and on like that, and I could argue with you about that issue, and I could prove to you that God exists. However, I could also prove to you in a couple of hours that God does not exist. Using the absolute opposite of those arguments. And see, it never made much difference to me. It just didn't matter, because that was not really a part of what I was about. It was not a part of my life to sit around worrying about issues like that. My life was about getting stuff. My life was about being successful and rich and famous. That's what my life was all about. I wanted to get stuff, because that's how you know that you're successful. How else are you going to know? How are they going to know? How's anybody going to know? You got to get a lot of stuff. So I set out in my early 20s to try to get some stuff, and I was very successful. I accumulated houses and cars and clothes, and I got married and had 6 children and took care of them, and, you know, it was just great. And I was, could point to my stuff at any given moment and say, Looky here. See how successful I am. I'm okay. I allowed what I did for a living to represent who I was for years. For years. I fell by accident into the radio broadcasting business and then ultimately into television, and I was a television newscaster, and I was a television news anchorman for an ABC station owned by ABC in Detroit when I was 26 years old. And I was making a ton of money. And I had a lot of stuff. But if anybody had asked me in all of those years, who are you? Nobody ever did, thank God. But if anybody had, if somebody had, you know, in some kind of a straight, serious conversation, which is the kind of conversation I never wanted to have with anybody. But if somebody had said, who are you? I would have said, I am a television newscaster who has a lot of stuff. And it never occurred to me that that has nothing to do with who I am. That's what I do. What I do is not who I am. I didn't know that. I found that out in AA. I found out everything in AA about me and about you and about life and about the world. Everything I learned here about real stuff, real things, real information about people. I learned here. I didn't know anything about people. I was in a people business all my life. I didn't know anything about people. How they feel? Do you think I care? Oh, I can simulate interest in your case for a little while. I can look like I care. I can be the most sincere-looking guy you ever met in your life. When you're telling me about the death in your family and the tragedy and the disease and the illness and the terrible things, I can look real sincere about that. I don't care! What do I care? Got to get my stuff. I haven't got time for that. But I learned very early on to simulate interest and to look as if I was normal and to look as if I were brave. I'm not brave. I'm a coward. I'm terrified of life. I'm terrified of people. I'm terrified of authority figures. I'm terrified of bosses. I'm terrified of wives. I'm terrified of children. I'm terrified of most things in my life. Just don't understand them and know how to deal with them. Don't know anything about them. I don't know how to be a father. I don't know how to be a husband. I don't know how to be a grown-up, for God's sake. I don't know. I'm just walking around in this frame, you know, 6 feet three, 200 pounds. If you think I'm fat now, I just lost 44 pounds. I want you to know that. Is that right, Kawega? Tell him, I'm not fat. True. She knows. But I'm walking around in this body, and I got a, you know, big time job. And I am somebody. And I look like I probably okay. And deep down inside, there's a little guy inside of me. He's about 4 feet tall, and he's scared to death all the time about failure. And he's terrified of success because he's afraid he's going to lose what he's got, and he's never going to get some more. And you know what? There's not enough stuff. You can never get enough. You can't. I got a lot, and it was never enough. As a matter of fact, there was one thing in my life that if you had just been willing to give it to me, I would have been okay. More. More money, more houses, more cars, more love, more sex, more everything. Just more. And then I'll be okay. You gotta treat me, and Clancy used to talk about this all the time, and I really identify with this. You gotta treat me real special just so I can feel equal. You gotta really, I could walk into this room tonight and everybody in this room except that lady in the red dress could come over and say hello to me, and I'd worry about her all night. I'd sit there and what the hell's the matter with her? Why didn't she come over? What's going on? It would never occur to me to walk over to her. It would never occur to me to go over, hi, how are you? That wouldn't occur to me. See, because I'm too involved in me. I'm too involved in this self-obsession game. This business of trying to look good and trying to feel good and not knowing how. And the only way that I discovered in my middle 20s that I can really feel better is if I drink. That's the only time I feel okay. And then well-meaning people who really seem to care about me will look at me and say weird things like, oh, you know, it looks like you might have a drinking problem. Do you ever think about quitting? No. They want to take away from me the only thing that makes me feel better, the only thing that allows me to function in the world, the only thing that allows me to be okay. Because periodically I got to get ripped. I got to. I mean, are you talking about just going through life day after day after gray goddamn day? Are you talking to me about life on a small screen in black and white, baby? You're talking to me about a 1935 William Powell movie here. Boring. And more boring. But when I have a couple of drinks, it's stereophonic sound and it's CinemaScope and it's full color. God, it's great. And I get drunk and I forget where I am, and I forget where my car is, and I travel, and I move around, and I irritate an awful lot of people, and I just... I do crazy things. I act in a way that I suppose people began to describe as bizarre. But I'm trying to be successful, and I'm trying to look good, and I'm trying to be a husband and a father and be all these things and be all things to all people, take care of the responsibilities of the bills and the kids and the family and the job. And at the age of 35, this disloyal woman divorced me. It's exactly how I felt about it. I've been taking care of her all these years. I give her these 6 kids. And now when the chips are down, when things are just really getting crazy, now that I'm over the hill, and that's how I felt at the age of 35, over the hill. I'm 53 now, and I feel pretty good. I don't feel 20, but I feel pretty good. But at 35, I felt scared, and I felt over the hill, and I felt down, and I felt depressed, and she was walking out on me. Leaving a sinking ship. Sure, we owed a lot of money. Got a few bad breaks. We owed thousands. And I had no way to pay it. We were losing the house. Finally, the court ordered the house sold anyway. And the 2 lawyers split what was left. I had a severe resentment against lawyers for a long time. But I now get my revenge. I sponsor a couple of them. You can bet they're working their steps. But I looked at this woman in this moment of desperation, in this moment of terrible trial in my life. I looked at her and I said, all right, I guess if you got to go, you got to go. I think it's a terrible mistake. I don't think you should do this. But if you got to go, you got to go. And all I could see was my own failure. Do you hear the ego in that? All I could see was my own failure in this divorce. I didn't see any of her pain. I didn't see what I'd done to her for years. I didn't see the things that I had brought home mentally and physically and just the awful stuff I'd done to her for years. I didn't see any of that. All I saw was my own failure. That's all I was thinking about. Because that's all I ever thought about. And I felt bad about it.
And I looked at her and I said, I guess if you got to go, you got to go. But I intend to demand custody of the 6 children. She looked at me and she said, okay. Somebody had taken her to just enough Al-Anon meetings, you know. But she was gone, and the house was gone, and I had these 6 kids, and I'm living in this apartment in Santa Monica, and I don't know what the hell to do. I had a job, and I was trying to work and trying to function, but I'm just crazy. And I'm on edge, and I'm nervous, and I'm just, I don't know what to do. And I felt just a lot of anxiety. And I don't know what other people do when they feel like that. I don't know what people do when the chips are down and it's all over and your back is against the wall and you know they're going to get you any minute. I don't know what other people do. I know what I do. I drink. Of course. Now, when I got drunk, I was sitting in an apartment in Marina Del Rey, California. A friend of mine had this apartment, and it was the middle of the night, and I'd had a couple of quarts of scotch and a half a bottle of Jim Beam, and I sobered up in the middle of the night. And I hated that. And I'd been calling people on the phone and telling them how disloyal she had been and how rotten my life was and how I'd been mistreated again and how I'd been screwed by life and nobody understood me and how bad it all was. I had a sad story. And they all hung up on me. Finally, they all hung up on me. My brother from Chicago, I used to call him once in a while. He said, I told you years ago you were drinking too much. You were destroying your body, destroying your family, ruining yourself. You can't listen to anybody, you arrogant son of a bitch. Just figure you don't have a brother anymore. And he hung up on me. And I felt bad. I was out of people. In my wallet, I had a card. It was the damnedest thing. A guy had given me this card some months earlier. I'd met him. And he was a guy who came to my house and picked my wife up and took her to these strange meetings. And he had been in my living room one night when I came in. And he didn't tell me, but I just knew he was one of them. So I questioned him. I'm a reporter. I know how to ask questions. How do you know you're an alcoholic? Well, I used to drink a lot of beer, he said. From 20 to 40 half quarts of beer a day, he told me. I never drank that much beer. Thank God. And he had been in the last days of his drinking, he'd been a cleaner of swimming pools. And he was down to one or two pools, throwing up in the ones that were left. I didn't clean swimming pools. I didn't throw up. For a long time in AA, that was one of the reasons I wasn't an alcoholic, by the way, because I never threw up. Everybody talked about throwing up. I said, well, I didn't throw up. I don't know. Can't be alcoholic. It's okay. If you're here and you never threw up, it's all right. But this guy had talked to me, and he told me, now get this, he told me he hadn't had a drink in 4 years. Well, I knew my case wasn't that severe. But I thought it might be interesting to quit for a while. I thought that thought occurred to me at that time. Well, now here it is some months later, and my wife is gone, and my house is gone, and my stuff is gone. And I'm living in this apartment with my kids, and I'm in another apartment. By the way, my children were 12 down to 1. And they were alone in this apartment. And I was in another apartment several miles away, drunk in the middle of the night. Now, that scared me a little. The thought occurred to me, you can't do this. And so I came across this guy's business card in my wallet, and I thought, well, I'll give him a call. They like to talk to drunks. What the hell? And so I called this guy, and I said, I got to tell you right up front, I'm not alcoholic. That's not why I'm calling you. I know that I don't have a drinking problem because when I drink, I feel better. And I have tried going on the wagon many, many, many times. And if I stay sober too long, I get crazier than hell. Sobriety gives me a lot of anxiety and frustration and pain, and I don't feel good if I'm sober too long, and that's why I drink. And he said, well, why don't we go to this meeting? And I said, well, I really don't join organizations, and I don't like to go to meetings. And I just thought maybe you could explain to me on the phone here how it is that you don't drink, and maybe I could do that for a little while. If I could just get my bills paid, if I could get my life organized a little bit, I'll be okay. Because I'm not really alcoholic. I'm a genuine person here. I got a job. I vote, for God's sake. And he said, well, he seemed to think it was important we go to this meeting. And it's so important, as a matter of fact, that he refused to give me any help if we didn't. And he didn't leave me a lot of room to run. And so I said, well, okay. So we went to this meeting. It was a men's stag in Beverly Hills. And then we went to the AA meeting, and I wasn't thrilled with this. They gave me a book. I wouldn't have bought it, but they handed me one. A guy said, all right, I bought you a book. Okay, fine. And they had about 60 guys in the meeting, and they all get up and do these three-minute talks, and they all tell these terrible stories. And the worse the stories get, the more the people seem to just think it's just funnier than ever. Jails and hospitals and institutions and just on and on it goes. And I didn't identify with most of that stuff. But of course, since I'm not alcoholic, I don't figure to, right? And we got through with the meeting, and they all got together and held hands and prayed. And I haven't held hands with a man since I was a child, and I certainly haven't prayed in a long time, and I'm not interested in that, and I'm not looking to be godlike, okay? I'm not looking for spirituality. I'm not looking for wonderfulness. I just want to get out from under the problems I got. I want to get my bills paid, for God's sake. I just want to get my life together. I want to get my head organized. That's all. And these people went out to a coffee shop after the meeting, and they just went on doing the same thing they'd been doing for 2 hours, talking about themselves. And they just seemed fascinated with all this stuff, and I wasn't. And then they talked about going to another meeting the next night. And I said, you mean you people do this every day? And they said, oh, yeah, it's wonderful. Alcoholics Anonymous is wonderful. And I knew they were just nuts. But this guy said, yeah, we'll pick you up. We'll take you to the meeting tomorrow night. And they did. And on and on. We went to a lot of meetings. Every day. Jesus. And I hated it. I hated the meetings. I hated, especially hated people that felt good. I did identify with what was going on. They talk about some steps, and just to emphasize that they read them at every meeting, like they couldn't remember them. And then they had something called the traditions. I don't know what the hell that was, and they'd read that. You know, sometimes they'd throw in chapter 3 or something just for variety. But it just, I don't know. I didn't understand what the hell was going on. I'm sitting in meetings. I don't understand. And this guy is saying, I think you got to get into action. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you got to be involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, well, I don't want to be involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I just don't want to drink. He said, oh, yeah, but it's important that you do certain things if you want to keep sober. I said, like what? He says, well, you go see that guy over there at the Tuesday night meeting and you ask him for a job in the meeting. And I became a floor mopper at the Tuesday night meeting. It's kind of demeaning for a man of my stature, but I decided I'd mop floors. They gave me the left side of the hall to mop every Tuesday night. I was beating the guy who was mopping the right side of the hall. every week. I'd finish my part first. He never knew there was a race, but you got to keep a little edge, you know. And I got a job making coffee at the Saturday night meeting, and I got a job as a greeter at the Thursday night meeting. I didn't like that particularly. I don't like to stand at the door and shake hands with people. I'm not gregarious and outgoing by nature. I told you, I don't like people. I'm just not into that. Who cares, you know? And then they started giving me, after I'd been around a couple of weeks, they gave me the addresses of some newcomers to pick up. And I felt that was stupid because I was a newcomer. You know, and they say, well, they're newer than you are. Well, what the hell, you know. I had 14 days and they had four, you know. And I say, what am I supposed to tell them? The truth? It'll drive them out of AA, I'll tell you that. Because I'll tell them this book is terribly written. It's just sophomoric and childish and way too simple for anybody with a brain. That there's a lot of God talk here, and I don't happen to believe in God, and AA is just a lot of nonsense, and they seem to just celebrate birthdays here and with birthday cakes and do all these dumb things, you know? Just it's just really stupid what's going on here. And they said, no, don't tell them anything. Just bring them to the meeting and we'll talk to them. So I'd go pick these guys up at these Skid Row hotels, and that's below my standards, too. I mean, I don't want to drive to these places in these neighborhoods and pick these people up. What the hell? You know, I'm kind of a big shot. Well, I used to be a big shot. But anyway, that's what I did. And I didn't do it because I like doing it. I did it because this guy said, you got to do these things. Now, you can't necessarily, if you don't want to do the stuff I'm telling you to do, it's perfectly all right. Just tell your next sponsor about it. And I knew what that meant. So I did it. What the hell? And one day I turned around and I made an interesting discovery, and I was surprised by it. What happened was, I was sober 6 months, and I was sitting in a meeting, and I discovered I hadn't had a drink in 6 months. Isn't that weird? And that surprised me. And I got thinking about those people who were taking those birthday cakes, and I got wondering what that would be like. And I thought, Jesus, I wonder if I could stay sober for a whole year. I wonder if I could really do that. Make a speech. Tell them all how stupid it really is. But I've stayed sober in spite of their book and in spite of their steps and in spite of their... I mean, come on. I mean, you walk in these meetings, they got... Here's the two founders, right? Our founders, you know. Hanging on the walls. Jesus. I start checking these guys out. You want to know about our founders? Come on. One guy is a broken-down hustler, stockbroker type of guy out of New York who never got rich even after he got sober. And the other guy is a drunken doctor from Akron, and you wouldn't let him lance a boil. And I don't see a lot of big, you know, I don't see major success here. And I'm into major success. In the meetings, and I'm hating it, and I'm thinking about getting a cake. And so I kept making coffee, and I kept picking up newcomers, and I kept mopping floors, and I kept greeting people, and I kept doing all of these things without ever knowing or understanding why I was doing any of them. I had no idea. I just did them. And Clancy said to me one time, he said, you know the real job of a sponsor in AA? I said, what's that? He said, it's just just to keep them amused until the program works. I thought sponsors were supposed to know something. And it turns out that's not what it is at all. It's just keep them amused, man. Just keep them busy. And that's what I did. I stayed busy. No, I did have a spiritual experience when I was 7 months sober. I was sitting in a meeting of AA, and I saw these legs walk by. And it was the days of the miniskirts, you know, and these are the greatest legs in North America that walk by. And it's this redhead, and she was just gorgeous. And I just started chasing her around meetings. And I was trying to get her to go out with me, and she'd say, how long have you been sober? I'd say, well, you know, I've been sober 6 or 7 months now. And she'd say, well, I don't date newcomers. She's been sober 3 years, right? Ha! She's still got 3 years on me. She calls me the newcomer and makes me get coffee. Imagine that. I get up in the morning, make a cup of coffee, take her in the coffee, I say good morning, and she'll say, oh, hello, newcomer. I don't need that kind of grief. But anyway, I started chasing her around the meetings, and I had another reason to go to AA, you know. And she had 2 children, and she looked at me one day and she said, how many children do you have? I said, well, I have 6, but they're very small. You'd hardly notice them. They're just... Well, for some reason or other, I talked her into getting married. When I was a year and a half sober, we got married. And then the battles began. Now, I thought if 2 alcoholics got married, that you just, I don't know, went through the tulips together and worked the steps. I don't know what the hell it was all about. It turns out on any given day in a residence occupied by 2 alcoholics, there is a serious question as to who's in charge. And I want to tell you, we fought and argued and hollered and screamed and carried on, and here we are with these 8 kids trying to look grown up, right? And the kids are looking at us, and they know we're nuts, and we're just carrying on like crazy. And when I was 2 and a half years sober, I got a big-time job back east with CBS, and I thought, now, baby, is my opportunity. This is going to happen now. I'm sober, and now I'm going to get my stuff again. Because that's what it's all about. And so I went back east and took her back east and we hauled the 8 kids back east. And we're back there trying to look grown up. But some very peculiar things happened. You remember, I've moved from one locale to another. I've changed something. You change anything in the life of an alcoholic, he ain't gonna like it. I translate different as bad. And I went to meetings back there, and they were different. They weren't like Southern California. And I just decided that I was going to do the only thing that any right-thinking egomaniac can do. I denied them my presence. I didn't go to their stupid meetings. I started a meeting California style, and we read Chapter 5, and we read the traditions, and we had birthdays. And back there, they don't do any of those things. And you get up and say, hi, my name is Barney, and I'm an alcoholic. They'll just sit there and look at you. Don't say hi to the speaker there. And they don't have birthdays. They call them anniversaries. And if you sponsor somebody in California, we call them a baby. Well, back there, they call them pigeons. And I said to, is that the way you do it here, too? See how weird you are? You didn't even know that. I said to this guy one night, I said, how come you call them pigeons? He said, on account of what they do to you.
It didn't say.
But I was working this job, and the ratings were not going up, and the people at CBS in New York were starting to look at me funny. And I was feeling pressure and anxiety and frustration and that terrible sense of fear again. And it was crawling all over me. And this woman I married seemed not to understand my sensitivity. And these children became teenagers. And they all grew fangs. And they seemed not to care what I thought. And after all, I'm an alcoholic, baby. I'm in charge here. And they didn't care. And I'm sober, and they didn't care. Because they weren't. They start drinking, using drugs, having all the time. And I'm walking around like I, you know, like I know what I'm doing. And this woman and I are fighting, and the kids and I are fighting, and the job is not going well, and I'm crazy. And a man with 17 years of sobriety sat down with me one night, and he said, "How's it going?" I said, "How much time have you got?" I said, "It's not going well at all. AA is not done for me. All these wonderful promises and this wonderful stuff AA talks about, it's all baloney, baby. For people like me. I guess if you're really dumb, you can kind of walk around and think it's okay. My life isn't getting any better." And I told him about the wife and the kids and the job and the problems I had and the anxieties and the frustrations. And I expected some sympathy from this guy. I expected some philosophy. I expected that he would sit and console me. He didn't do that. He looked at me and he said, "Get this. How many meetings do you go to?" I said, "What the hell's that got to do with anything? I've been sober for 3 years. I'm not drinking." No. "How many newcomers you work with?" I said, "Phil, you're not listening to me. Newcomers. I don't work with newcomers. I don't like newcomers. I'm not interested in doing that. I used to try to work with newcomers and they all got drunk. I don't do that." I said, "Besides, I haven't met any newcomers here on the East Coast." He said, "Yes, I know. They go to those meetings you don't attend." He said, "What are you doing about the third step?" I said, "I don't believe in God." He said, "That's not what I asked you." I said, "Yeah, I think you did." He said, "No." I said, "What are you doing about the third step?" I said, "How can you do anything about the third step or even the second step if you don't believe in God?" He said, "Oh, that's easy." Picked up the book, opened it up, found the third step prayer. He said, "You say that every day." I said, "That's stupid." He said, "Why?" I said, "Because you're praying to something you don't believe in." He said, "Right." I said, "That's phony. It makes me feel like a phony." He said, "That's all right. You are a phony." I said, "Mean I say a phony prayer?" He said, "Sure." To a phony God? Absolutely. Why not? What else you got going for you? So I start going to these meetings. That's what he told me to do. He said, "Go to the meetings. Put your ass in the chair, leave your head outside, but go to the meetings. Don't try to share with them all of your wonderfulness. Just sit there. They don't care what you think. You're sick." So I go to the meetings and I listen and he said, "Go work with newcomers." Now, I don't want to do that. But I start threatening them. I grab some newcomer at the end of the meeting. I say, "Hey, you! You call me at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning!" And you know, some of them did. And some of them stayed sober, and I don't know what to do with them when they're sober. They come in your living room, they come in the kitchen, they're on the phone all the time. You can't get rid of them.
What meeting are we going to tonight?
What do you mean, we? You're the newcomer, Gobsnivel.
Then, I don't know what else to do with them, I started doing something I never thought I'd do with anybody. I started opening the zipper and let them see what's inside. I started telling them the truth. I don't want to do that, but I don't know what else to do with these guys. And so I'd say, look, I am a sick son of a bitch. Do you understand that? I don't believe in God. I say a prayer I don't believe in. I go to the stupid meetings. I've been sober now for a while, but I don't know what's going on here. I don't really work the steps like they work the steps. I don't hate the book. I am the most insincere man you ever met. I don't even like you. The only reason I'm sitting here listening to you is because somebody told me to do it. Because I don't care about you. And the sick people I got, they look at me and say, I identify with that.
All right, let's just go to a meeting. I don't know.
I got fired from that job back east, and I felt like a failure again, and I felt like a loser again, and I felt like I was dying again, and I went back to California, and I went to work in San Diego, and I worked there for about a year, and I quit my job. And I was going to meetings, and I was working with newcomers, and I was saying that stupid prayer, and I was dying, and I was 6 years sober. If you're new, I ain't no rock at the stardom, baby. And I didn't work for about 5 months in 1978. And something very peculiar happens when I don't work. I run out of money. That's why it's so funny, guys I work with, you know, every once in a while they start crying to me about their money.
I don't have any money and I haven't got a car and I can't afford to take the goddamn bus every day and try to look for a job and nobody wants to hire me. I'm so behind on my child support. I feel so bad because I'm broke all the time. I just look at him and I say, get a job!
Mr. Sympathy. Go get a job. Just get any kind of a stupid job. Who cares? Make $3 an hour is better than what you made last week. But I worked for 5 months in 1978 and I ran out of money. And my wife, this wonderful AA member that I was married to, and she looked at me one day, this wonderful woman who was my great support. She says, you've got to be the biggest loser I ever met. She said, are you going to get a job or what? I said, I don't know. I'm sitting in the tower of my house looking at the ocean and meditating. She said, well, I got to leave because I can't stand this anymore. I can't stand to live this way anymore. I can't be in this environment anymore. You're so depressed all the time. Then I knew she was right. I knew she had to go. And the bank was going to take my house, and I knew that was coming. I was 3 months behind in the mortgage. And I felt so bad. I'm 6 years sober. I got babies of mine coming over to my house in a Mercedes-Benz
asking me how to work the steps. How do you work step three?
I said, I don't know. I never tried that one.
I went and sat in front of a bar for 2 hours one night. Because ultimately my solution to these kinds of problems is the same solution that it always was. Why would it change? Why would anything about that change? When I'm desperate and I'm alone and I'm crazy and I have no answers and no real solutions left in my life and I just know that I'm screwed again, what else is there left for me? I gotta get drunk. That's the only thing I got.
Run a drug screen. In other words, they can
isn't
just
it?
Say, I think you're using drug test.
And I sat in front of that bar
29%
for 2 hours.
I was surprised that was that low.
And for some reason or other,
I was surprised that was that
I had the sense that drinking wasn't going to help either.
Insurance companies after
and
that
that's really sad.
25% of the companies had
when you finally know the only answer you ever really had ain't gonna work. I guess I've gone to too many meetings.
Okay. Let's talk
I was screwed.
Specifically.
I went down and sat on the beach in La Jolla, and it was midnight, and it was March, and it was cold. And I was alone. And I sat on that beach, and I cried, and I cried, and I cried, and I felt terrible about me. And I felt totally self-obsessed again. And I felt like an utter and complete failure again. I was losing another wife. My kids were crazier than hell. I had no control over them. I didn't seem to be able to work. I was never, 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 ever going to be the richest man in the cemetery. And I finally knew it. And I felt terrible. And I cried and I cried and I cried. For some reason, I found myself saying that stupid prayer. And I sat there and I thought, why do you say that prayer? You don't believe in God. And finally, I just looked up and I got this sensation, and I don't know where the hell it came from, that I wasn't alone anymore. And I thought, God, this is weird. You're getting as weird as the rest of them. And I looked up and I said, all right, you SOB. You screwed me all my life. I give up.
Actually, I was just in.
You got to be careful what you say. Because if I had any sense that night that I was beginning the long and horrible and ugly process of surrender, I probably wouldn't have done it. But that's what was going on. See, what I had not understood and the part that I had missed was so simple. It was, you know what the third step says? I missed it. It says, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understand them. You know that's everything? I didn't know that. That's all there is. It never dawned on me for a long time. I had surrendered my right to drink 6 years earlier. That's all. I just surrendered my right to drink. And I went to meetings and I did the things. But that's it. All that was it. What I never surrendered and turned over to anyone other than a sponsor for a brief period of time was all the rest of my life. My kids, my wife, my job, everything, including my stuff. I decided I'd just get some stupid job anyplace. I didn't care where it was. I just seemed unable to function anymore, and I just couldn't be successful, and I knew that. And so I just was going to get a dumb job someplace, and all I knew to do was just go to the job every day and show up and look alert. I didn't know to do anything else. I got nothing left anymore that could impress one more boss one more time with my wonderfulness. I couldn't do that anymore. I was tired of trying. I'd failed drunk and I'd failed sober.
That's right.
Why the hell would I try that again? That's just go get a job, show up, and look alert. That's it. So I did. Got a dumb job. And start showing up every day. Just did what they tell me to do. I was working as a reporter at a television station in Los Angeles where I used to be the anchor man. And that was demeaning, and it was hard to do, and it was difficult, but I didn't have much ego left, so it didn't matter. I just wanted to show up and look alert and not get fired, that's all. And so I start showing up every morning, and I did what they told me to do, and I said, okay, and I went and did it. And about 3 months into that, a man walked up to me who was the news director for that operation, and he said, hey, he says, I'm really glad I hired you. And I said, oh, you are? He said, yeah. He said, we got to have a contract here. And I said, well, okay. He said, well, we're going to sit down and negotiate. I said, well, I don't negotiate anymore. He said, well, who's your agent? I said, I don't have an agent anymore. He said, well, how are we going to negotiate? I said, why don't you just write a number on a piece of paper and I'll sign it. How would that be? He said, you're not the same Barney Morris I used to know. He used to fight for every penny, every nickel, every dime. I said, I don't care anymore. That's not important to me. I said, I just have to show up here every day and do what I'm supposed to do. He said, I don't understand that. I said, I know that. And so he put a number on the piece of paper, which, by the way, was much bigger than anything I would have asked him for. And I laughed and I signed it. And 5 years later, another contract and the same kind of thing. No negotiations, no deals, no nothing. Just put the number on a piece of paper. You pay me whatever the hell you think this job is worth, and it's fine with me. You want to know something really weird? I make more money today than I have ever made in my life. I haven't asked them for a dime. I haven't asked them for a raise. I don't go for my rights anymore. I'm not interested in justice. As a matter of fact, it has finally occurred to me, if I ever go for justice, I'm in big trouble. This week I'm working on mercy.
That's right.
My marriage. Oh, God. Didn't know what to do about that.
No.
She was leaving and I knew that and I didn't know what to do. And I decided what I will do, I will just go home and do at home what I do at work. I'll just try to show up and look alert. Because I don't know how to make her happy. I don't know how to make her love me. I don't know how to deal with a woman. I never have been able to deal with a woman. I'm good, you know, 28 minutes, and then it's all over with me. I'm pretty good for about 20, and then forget it. I don't know how to handle them. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to make her happy. I don't know what to do. And so I decided that I would do what my sponsor told me to do. He said, you go home and put your hands on her shoulders and look at her and say, how are you? And then the hard part, you have to listen for the answer. And he said, you're not allowed to tell her how you feel unless she asks. And you know what? Sometimes she don't ask. But Carol and I now have been married, I don't know, 16 years almost. That's got to be some kind of a miracle. And we're getting along pretty good now. Matter of fact, she is a much better member of AA than I am because she genuinely cares about people. And I still have to fake it most of the time. But I have learned through, working with newcomers and being with people and talking to people and trying to listen to them. I have begun to learn how to care a little bit. It's scary, kind of. Because a lot of feelings involved there. And it's not something I enjoy all the time. But that's all part of it. But the newcomers in my life, because I have been willing to open the zipper and let them see what's inside, have saved my ass. Absolutely and totally saved my ass. And I'm very grateful that I have them. Not every day, but I'm grateful most of the time. In a general way, I'm grateful. On a specific basis, I'm not too thrilled most of the time. But, you know, because the last thing I want, come on, I don't want some guy calling me and calling me with his problems. I want to tell him about mine. And usually that's what I do. The children, we have eight kids. Some of them use drugs and drank, and the oldest boy now has been sober over 8 years in AA.
All right.
And we had nothing to do with that. He just decided he didn't want to die. And he married a girl in AA, and they had a couple little alcoholic babies. And I have a son who's a doctor. I have a son who is a... and by the way, the doctor saved my life 3 weeks ago. Isn't that interesting that I should know that? I was describing some simple little symptoms I was having in my left eye about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And I thought it was an eye problem. And he said, Dad, that's not an eye problem. You got to have tests right away. And I was about, you know, that close to a stroke. And they ran me into UCLA Medical Center and opened up this carotid artery and went in there and did their thing and cleaned me out. And and I'm standing here. And so he's a pretty good doctor, I guess. He gets my vote this week. And any minute now, this weekend, he's expecting a child, he and his wife. And I told him to hold off till Sunday. I'll be back Sunday. And I said, you got to wait till Sunday. And he said, we'll do the best we can. I have daughters who work in television production in Hollywood, and they do very well. And when the six of the kids are married, we have a sadness in our life in that the oldest boy now and his wife appear to be headed for Divorceville. And that's sad, and it's hard to take, but it's life, and it's part of it. And, you know, what I've learned in AA is that what we are dealing with here is life, and all we're doing is showing up for it, and we're going through the pain and the sadness and the agony and the good stuff and the bad stuff. And one of the good things and one of the wonderful pit stops in life, I suppose, is this conference in Omaha, Nebraska. You know, we come here, it's like a pit stop. You know, we're all out there running on the track every day, and the cars are, you know, the wheels are getting worn down, and we're running out of oil, and we're getting tired out there. We come in, get the pit stop, baby, get some tires, get some oil, get some gasoline, get zipped up a little bit, so we can go back out on that track on Monday morning and start going all over again. Because, you know, if you're new and you have less than a year, when you hit a year, there's no tape to run through here. We are not running a race. There is no tape to run through. You just, what happens is you get 365 days. And then you get 366 days. And then you get 367 days. And you just, and they use the right word, trudge the road of happy destiny. And on it goes. It's the best deal I ever had, this thing, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the best deal I ever had. I'm very grateful to be a member of AA. I never thought that I would feel that way, but I do today. I am learning a little bit about caring and loving. Amazing for a person like me. To even begin to get a little bit of that. To begin to understand a little bit about how it feels to really care about somebody. I'm learning how to do that here. A little bit. What the hell? I've only been sober 17 years. I figure in time... And meanwhile, it's just another day, another day, another day. Go to Omaha. Open the zipper. Let them see what's inside in Omaha. You know. Go talk to all these people you don't know about this thing you don't do anymore. And maybe you won't have to have a drink that night. And then that will have worked, and you go on to the next event. But I'm grateful to the committee for asking me to come here. I'm grateful for being a part of your lives. I'm grateful for the fact that I can be with people like you and be with the sick, you know, alcoholics that I know are sick alcoholics. I mean, we are all sick cookies, baby. We need one another desperately. And it's great that we can be in this kind of forum and do this kind of deal. It's fun, and I can take a piece of you with me tomorrow. I'll get on the big bird and fly back to California and get back out on that track again. And start all over again. maybe have another grandchild, and maybe not have another grandchild, and maybe have a job, and maybe not have a job, and maybe have death, and maybe have disease, and maybe have good stuff, and maybe have bad stuff. I don't know. But whatever it is, it'll be a hell of a lot easier if I've got you. It will be better somehow if I have you. And when I walk out of here tonight, and when I leave here tomorrow, I will take a piece of you with me. That's the magic here. I can take you with me. And you can have a piece of me. See? That's what we got here. A little piece of one another. And it's a... If you are new, I can't hand it to you. I can't give it to you. I can't hand you 17 years of sobriety. I wouldn't do it anyway. Because you would miss the trip. And the journey is what it's all about. So I thank you for being a part of my life tonight and being a part of my AA world. And I got to tell you that I am learning how to love you, and for that I am eternally grateful. Thank you. Oh!